Georgia. I've preached at many of the cities in this region, and I'm delighted to be in your presence today. I shall preach this morning from the Old Testament book of 2 Samuel, chapter 21. 2 Samuel, chapter 21, beginning at verse 1. The title of my sermon is Rizpah Upon the Rock, or A Strange Providence. Have any of you ever noticed that sometimes providence will knock you down? And while you are down, it'll kick you in the ribs. Sometimes the providences of God are bitter. They are hard, and yet they are the providences of God nonetheless. And in the sermon today, I want to help you to see the strange providence in the life of this lady named Rizpah. Rizpah upon the rock. Have you found the text? Let's begin at verse 1. Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, "It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites." Then the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the children of Israel had sworn unto them, and Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, What shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And the Gibeonites said unto him, We will have no silver nor gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. And he said, That which ye say will I do for you. And they answered the king, The man that consumed us and that devised against us, that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coast of Israel. Let 7 men of his sons be delivered into our hands, that we might hang them up before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose. And the king said, I will give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. But the king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth, and the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. And he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the hill before the Lord. And they fell, all 7 together, and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of the barley harvest. And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock from the beginning of the harvest until rain fell upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest upon them by day, nor the beast of the field by night. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son and buried them. If you look down to verse 14, he buried them in the sepulcher of Kish, his father. Now, I have three items in my sermon. I want to talk about the historical circumstances. Do you remember those circumstances surrounding this story? And then I want to talk about the holy character of Rizpah. And thirdly, I want to give you some hallowed conclusions that can easily be drawn from this passage. This story is first told in the Old Testament book of Joshua, chapter 9. You remember, the Lord told Joshua and the Israelites, when you enter into Canaan, don't leave any of the inhabitants remaining. They'll be a thorn in your flesh. They'll turn your hearts away from the Lord your God. Don't leave any of them remaining. They have conquered Jericho. They have captured Ai. And the fear and the dread of them has fallen upon the inhabitants of the land. The Gibeonites dwelt there, you remember? And they devised an ingenious plan. They selected a small group of emissaries and dressed them in old clothes, gave them old shoes, dried molded bread. And these emissaries came to Joshua and they said, "We are from a far country, but we've heard about you and about your God, and we've come to make a league with you." And Joshua said, "How shall I know but what you dwell in the land?" And they said, "Oh my, look at us. Our clothes were new when we left home. This bread was freshly baked." Sounded like a politician in an election year. They lied like a yellow dog. "We're from a far country. Make a league with us." And Joshua did not inquire of the Lord. And he made a league, a covenant, promising not to destroy them. Soon thereafter, he discovered he had been deceived. And some of the men in his army rose up and would have slain the Gibeonites then and there. But Joshua said, "No. We have sworn before the Lord and we cannot go back." So they made the Gibeonites to be servants. They'd chop the wood and they'd draw the water for the Israelites. And this arrangement persisted for over 400 years. But when Saul became the first king in Israel, for reasons not given in the Bible, he began to kill off many of the Gibeonites. Now, Bible scholars quibble regarding his motive. Some say that Saul is a despot. He enjoyed the carnage. Others say that he's trying to make amends for his earlier debacle when God sent him to destroy the Amalekites. He was not to take any of the spoil or leave any alive. But he kept the best of the cattle and the sheep, you remember? And he kept Agag, king of the Amalekites, as a trophy of his victory. And when the prophet Samuel met him in the way as he returned from the battle, Saul proudly announced, "I have done all that the Lord my God commanded me." And Samuel said, "What then meaneth this lowing of the oxen and this bleating of the sheep in mine ears? To obey is better than sacrifice, to hearken than the fat of rams." Others ascribe a more noble motive. They say that Saul is reverting to the original command to leave none of the inhabitants remaining. Now, regardless of his motive, this much we know, he breached the covenant. He broke the promise. And 30 years after the death of Saul, when David is on the throne in Israel, God sends a famine. It persists for 3 years. And in our passage, David has gathered the leaders of the Gibeonites, and he is seeking to make amends. He says, "What can we do?" And they respond by saying, "We don't want you to put anyone to death. We don't want any financial remuneration. What we prefer is that you deliver into our hands 7 of the sons of Saul." He perpetrated this crime against us. "Give us 7 of his sons, and we will hang them up in Gibeah, and we will be satisfied." And the king has agreed. He's taken these 2 sons of Rizpah and the 5 sons of Michal. It's along about the middle of April, at the beginning of the barley harvest, and they are hung there, suspended between heaven and earth. These are the historical circumstances. Now put that aside. And here's the second item. You like my transitional statement? A lot of preachers go to school forever trying to learn this. They want to be smooth in their transitions. But for a country preacher like myself, it's just not a big deal. When I get through one item, I'll announce it. I'm done with that. And here's the next item. I want to talk to you about the holy character of Rizpah. Do you remember Rizpah from your reading of the scriptures? She had been married to the king as a concubine. She had enjoyed all of the privileges of royalty. But her character is best viewed against the backdrop of her great disappointment in life. You see, her husband has died. Do you remember how Saul died? The Philistines wounded him in a battle, but he did not die. He was fearful that they would torture him, so he impaled himself on his own sword, but still, his life remained. And when a young man passed by, Saul said, "Come near, take your sword and thrust me through, lest these uncircumcised Philistines abuse me." When they discovered the body of Saul and the body of his son Jonathan, they hanged them up in the street of Bethshan. It was in this time that she has experienced great disappointment. How can you describe the grief of heart and mind when a person loses their mate? What disappointment. But that's not all. This lady, Rizpah, has been sexually abused. The captain of the host of the Israelite army has been publicly reprimanded for sexually abusing these concubines of Saul. How can you articulate the horror that a lady experiences when she is violated in such a fashion as this? I don't know about you folks here in Perry, Georgia, but I have got some down-home thinking about that. Are you alarmed at the onslaught of sexual abuse in our land? Are you alarmed at the onslaught of child sexual abuse? It is my opinion that when a man is adjudicated and found to be guilty of sexually violating a small child. And the judge gives him a 60-day jail term with mandatory treatment. I believe the judge ought to be hanged. That brings the judgment of God upon the land. What disappointment. She has been deposed from the palace. She is now dependent on Armoni and Mephibosheth, her two boys, for her daily sustenance. Perhaps she has entertained a notion that one day David, the man after God's own heart, would restore her to a position of dignity in the land. And the horsemen ride up to her gate and dismount. But instead they take hold of her two boys and commence to drag them away. And when she says, "What's this about?" They say, "Stand back, lest you lose your own life." She follows them at a distance. She watches in abject horror. She watches in disbelief. When they come to the hill at Gibeah, she watches as they hang her two boys, the objects of her affection. And their five cousins. She waits until at last the soldiers have moved away. And it's then and it's there that Rizpah commences this vigil. She spreads a sackcloth upon the rock. And she commences this vigil in the daylight hours when the vultures soaring above would swoop down to tear the flesh of these boys. She rises up and drives them away. And in the midnight, though she is exhausted from lack of sleep, when the jackals of the forest would come to devour the flesh of these boys, she rises up and with courage that she had never known before, with discipline and determination, she rises up and she drives them away, and she does it day after day and night after night. She sees their flesh emaciate. She sees their flesh drop from their bones and their bones bleach white in the noonday sun. But she will not relent. She keeps this vigil. Without a doubt, friends or neighbors come. They take her by the arm. They turn her around. They say, "Come on home with us now. There's nothing more to do here. Don't be delusional. You cannot restore their lives. It's over. Come on with us. We will care for you. We will help you. Come on." But she will not relent. And yet she's not delusional, nor does she believe that she can restore their lives. There is in the heart of this mother a glimmer of hope, a ray of light. Perhaps even now she could at least give them a decent burial, a noble interment. And as long as there's this glimmer of hope, she will not relent. She keeps the vigil from the middle of April until October, when the fall rains come. I submit for your consideration, this is honorable character. I say, God bless Rizpah. And furthermore, I say, dear God, give us some more Rizpahs in our day. Wouldn't it be something if during these 4 days, if God were to raise up a new generation of parents and grandparents who are absolutely convinced that while their children are yet alive, they, as parents, have no greater responsibility than to bring those children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't it be something if God raised up a new generation of parents and grandparents who are convinced that personal purity and righteousness and holiness of life is more important than academics and accolades and athletics? Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't it be something if God raised up a new generation these days who are convinced that it's more important for their children to be familiar with the 12 patriarchs of the Old Testament and the 12 apostles of the New Testament than for them to be familiar with every video game that Hollywood can produce? Wouldn't that be something? There are vultures soaring up above, waiting, watching for just the right moment to swoop down and destroy your children. There are enemies lurking in the dark and secret places just waiting to destroy and devour. God, give us some rizpahs in our day. Are you folks getting any of this yet? Do you know what I might do if I got to thinking that you weren't getting this? Well, I'd stop. And I'd go back and repeat every single word. You can't fire me anyway. Now, here's the third item. Didn't I tell you I had three items? I've given you the historical circumstances. I've talked about the holy character of Rizpah. Now, I want to give you some hallowed conclusions. And perhaps I ought to caution you, because there are several of these. Are you able? All right, here's number one. Sometimes God uses natural calamity as punishment for sin. It, the famine, is for Saul and his bloody house. Can it be any clearer? Can it be any plainer than this? Now, don't come up to me after the service, especially while I'm eating my lunch, and say, "Preacher, what about Hurricane Katrina?" I don't know. The Bible didn't say anything about Katrina. It's the preacher's business to preach what the Bible says.
Amen.
The Bible didn't say every natural calamity is God's punishment for sin. But it says this calamity was sent by God to punish Saul. Did you see it there? Sometimes God uses natural calamity as punishment for sin. Number two. When God sends judgment, it is appropriate, it is fitting for His children to inquire why. David inquired of the Lord. Now, I would suggest that David himself would have been better served if he had not waited 3 years. At the first glimpse, at the first indication of God's displeasure, the church ought to fall upon its knees and inquire of the Lord. Number three, the wheels of justice grind slowly, but they grind nonetheless, and they grind exceedingly fine. I cannot answer your question. Why did God wait 30 years after the death of Saul before He sent the punishment? I don't know the answer to that question. I do know this, that His ways and His thoughts are higher than our ways and our thoughts. I do know this, the God, the judge of all the earth, will do right. I would ask you this. Why should you and I be willing and anxious, eager, to enjoy the privileges and the benefits and the blessings that have accrued unto us from previous generations, and not be willing to suffer some of the consequences for their sins? It's a two-edged sword, isn't it? Number four, sometimes children suffer because of the sins of the parents. In the Decalogue of Exodus 20, we are told, "For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." Here are two first generation descendants and five second generation descendants of Saul. Let me tell you something about these boys. They would have died. It's appointed unto men once to die. Let me tell you something else about them. They died in Adam. They possessed original sin. They were naturally depraved. And the wages of sin is death. They would have died. But the reason they died this infamous, untimely death is the direct consequence of Saul's sin. I have wished God hadn't said that. Are you a parent? A grandparent? Oh, that puts us in the dust, doesn't it? That causes us to tremble, doesn't it? And yet it's true that sometimes children suffer because of the sins of the parents. Number five. Providence is personal, but providence is bigger than just one person. Providence was personal to Rizpah. She wrestled with those tough questions. Why has God allowed this to happen to me? Have I not suffered enough? Is it not enough my husband has died, that I have been sexually abused, that I'm dependent on these two boys for my livelihood? Lord, if you love me, why have you allowed this? Lord, where are you when I need you the most? How am I going to pay the bill? Lord, if you're in control, for heaven's sakes, why don't you do something? Are you listening? It was personal. It affected her. It impacted her at the deepest levels of her being, her mind, her heart, her will. We're all shaken, impacted. It was personal. And yet, she had to discover that it wasn't all about her. That she was only making a cameo appearance in a much larger drama. It was about God. It was about sovereignty. It was about providence carrying out an eternal plan and purpose. Beloved, you and I need to be reminded occasionally that it's not all about us either. That's right. I was checking to see if y'all are still awake on this. Number six. Sometimes parents suffer unspeakable sorrow because of trouble with their children when the parents are not to blame. You will search the Bible in vain to find even one scintilla of evidence that Rizpah ever sloughed off as a parent, that she is ever negligent or delinquent. It was not her fault. It was Saul's fault. It was the fault of the father, the grandfather. And though she is not culpable, though she is not to blame, she experiences tremendous pain, suffers unspeakable sorrow because of the trouble with her sons. And does it not happen that way today? Is it not true that sometimes a child is born to a good and godly home? They are Baptist even. They come to church. They daily seek to instill biblical principles and promises into their children. They bring them here to the house of God for further instruction. They pray. They take their responsibilities seriously. And yet those children become older teenagers or young adults, and for reasons that mystify their parents, they sometimes take a left turn and they go out into the world to follow the flesh and the devil. And it may very well be true that in this congregation today there are parents or grandparents who went to sleep sorrowful and heavy of heart and even weeping last night because of trouble with your children and your grandchildren. And if that were not enough, if that by itself were not enough, the accuser of the brethren comes. He comes and he says, it's your fault. No wonder your daughter's in trouble. You knew better. You knew she'd be vulnerable. Why did you allow her to go? No wonder your son is rebellious. It was your way or the highway. You were too strict. You were too lenient. Are you listening? He points his finger at you and he will beat you up and he will disarm you and disable you and destroy you if you are not mature, if you are not discerning. You must go back. You must retrace your steps. You must remind yourself that you received your children as gifts from God. You must remind yourself that on your best day, you were never perfect as a parent. You knew that. You've discovered that if you didn't know it. On our best day, we're imperfect. But it was the furthest thing from your heart and your mind that your son might grow up to be rebellious, that your daughter might be promiscuous. No, it was the furthest thing from your mind. And I tell you, the hardest thing parents ever are called to do is to say, Lord, I turn them over completely to you to do that which only God is able, and then trust the Lord with your children. Are y'all getting this? Number 7. Character is not made in a crisis. It's manifested. Number 8. Sometimes a child of God will have their greatest victories, their greatest influence in the midst of their deepest disappointments. I want you to look at verse 11. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead, which had stolen them from the street of Bethshan when the Philistines had slain Saul in Gilboa. Would you have ever dreamed that this concubine would have influenced the mighty monarch of Israel, to do something he had been negligent about for 30 years. One of the first things David should have done in his administration was to send an envoy to Jabesh-Gilead, 20 miles west of the Jordan River, to retrieve the bones of the king of Israel. You bury the king, even if he's a Democrat. You bury the king, even if he's a Republican. He might not be of your political stripe, but if he's the king, he's God's appointed leader. And with dignity, with pomp and circumstance, you bury the king. But for 30 years, David has been negligent. Would you imagine for a moment that you and I, just you and I, are sitting out in the woods on a log, you on one end and me on the other, and we're discussing what might be required for revival to take place. If we were reading this passage of Scripture, might we not conclude that some of God's children might have to go back 30 years and undo some of the mistakes that they've made? Would that be an obvious conclusion to come to? Do you know what Baptist churches are known for today? It's no longer pie and ice cream socials. We're known for getting enough people together that we can choose up sides and have a big fight over something. Here's how it happens. A little group gets their feelings hurt because they can't have their way. And they begin to pray and they pull out and go down the street a few blocks and crank up another church. Likely as not, they'll name it Fellowship. Or unity, or perhaps some other similar name. Emmanuel, God is with us. We're not up there anymore. Do you ever know of that happening? And little silver-haired ladies that can make the best apple pie you ever tasted will become meaner than a junkyard dog. They'll give the preacher a cussing right out here on the parking lot. And some of the old mossbacks sitting on a pile of cash, big enough they could burn a wet mule on a rainy day at the bottom of the lake. They got Walmart stock they bought back in the 80s. They don't even know how much it's worth. They hadn't given $1,000 to God's church in 10 years. If you're trying to figure that out, that's less than $10 a month. But now that that fellowship crowd left, they'll get off of some of those bucks, start giving money to the church. It's not because they love Jesus or concerned about lost souls. You know why they do it? Because they don't want to bump into some of that Emmanuel crowd down at Walmart without having the unmitigated pleasure of being able to say, "Well, let me tell you this. Since you all left, our budget hadn't gone down one dime. Why don't you put that in your pipe and smoke it?" Now, is that the truth or not? If you don't understand that that is the gospel truth, you hadn't been around Baptist life long. And the rhetoric is at a fever pitch. There's a cloud of